Welcome to Business Watch. The energy crisis in South Africa is draining morale faster than strained batteries during load shedding, as the stark facts are that load shedding, rolling blackouts, have been a feature of South Africa for 15 years, more than half of the time that the ANC has been in power. And make no mistake, the ANC does have a lot to answer for, because its members make up the ranks of the cabinet ministers who have largely been responsible for our inability to tackle the crisis head on. Now, the president alluded to the fact that a plan is being hatched. Yes, another one. President Ramaphosa says that he will in the coming days announce a comprehensive set of actions to achieve much faster progress in tackling load shedding, which has worsened significantly over the last 3 years and has intensified in recent weeks to the point of being implemented at stage six. In his weekly newsletter, the president acknowledged that it was no time for business as usual, adding that we need to act boldly to make load shedding a thing of the past. Powerful words, those. He stressed that while there were no easy solutions, government was committed to exploring every avenue and using every opportunity to ensure that we generate enough electricity to meet the country's needs. Now, the question is, do we need a state of emergency when the minister is empowered to clear away red tape by the Electricity Regulation Act, the ERA? And too often around the world, and here in South Africa, we have seen a crisis manufactured into a gateway for corruption. Well, I'm joined now by Mark Swilling with his National Planning Commission hat on as Commissioner of the MPC, which has called on this special emergency situation approach, the coalition of the willing, if you will. Joanne Bates, Chief Operating Officer of the Industrial Development Corporation, and Thabo Molekoa, who is the MD of Siemens Energy. Mark, kick us off. This sounds very much like the plan that we spoke about after you wrote your op-ed in the Daily Maverick and the more detailed paper with the Blended Finance Institute. 10 gigs of new energy, 5 gigs of storage. Is it technically and financially feasible to end load shedding in 24 months?
It definitely is. It is because renewable energy technologies can be constructed within a 24-month period. If we move quickly, we can, over and above what's already going to be procured, add an additional 10,000 megawatts of new generation capacity and 5,000 megawatts of storage. And if we make the decisions and cut the red tape, we could move quickly and end load shedding in 24 months.
So take me through what your proposals are as the MPC to cut that red tape and to ensure that we can deliver this in the next 24 months.
Well, you know, we discussed it at length in the National Planning Commission, and we came to the conclusion that what is really needed is what you could call an energy emergency. It's not a state of emergency as such, and not necessarily a state of disaster, but a commitment by everybody to deal with this as an emergency. And that would create the necessary focus, you know, like we had at the beginning of the pandemic, where we had these regular family meetings where we were updated on progress. That's the kind of political process that would create a national goal that we can all unite around, mission-driven. And then the interventions that will be necessary. I mean, we did see a press statement from the presidency, which we welcome, that the president is leading and responding to the crisis. But what powers does he have to override some of the blockages? And that's really, you know, what we need to pay attention to, because some of those blockages really are going to retard. We have a perfect system for a normal situation, but we're in an abnormal situation and we need special measures. It's a bit like being invaded by a foreign power. You need war measures.
And you know, that was my concern when the statement was first released, and I thought of a state of emergency or a state of disaster, for example, because it does potentially open the back door for those special interests that had blocked renewables for 7 years being added to the grid, big coal, nuclear, gas to get in through the back door. And then once they're in the door, it's very difficult to get them out. They lock in, and you've locked in that decision for the next 20-odd years. So one has to be very mindful here, because the existing legislation does empower the minister to grant licensing requirement and registration requirement exemptions under the ERA. So what do you see as the special measures that would be implemented under an emergency approach without being under a state of emergency?
Well, it's measures that would make it possible, for example, to very quickly lift the ceiling on the 100 megawatt ceiling on registration. It would mean, for example, putting in place an exemption to local content requirements, which is temporary while alternatives are worked out, would mean putting in place an enabling framework very quickly that would allow municipalities to procure energy from IPPs. It would also mean creating a more favorable framework for those households and factories that want to put renewables on the rooftop, where at the moment, there aren't sufficient incentives for that other than energy security. Mm. So those are the kinds of examples that would make it possible to really unleash. You could also significantly expand the size of Bid Window 6 from the current 2,500 megawatts. You could make it 10.
Yeah, I mean, why exactly? I think a lot of people in an emergency situation are questioning, why are we even putting limits on this? We need every electron onto the grid as soon as possible as we labor under this situation, and it is going to get worse. As we know, the EAF has been declining at Eskom, old kit that is really being held together with sticky tape and chewing gum, it would seem, at the moment. Tabo, from your vantage point, what do you make of these proposals to build a kind of coalition of the willing to have an emergency framework and kind of a warlike approach to the way we tackle the country's energy crisis?
Michael, I think on the whole, we're in agreement that I think we're sitting in an approach where we do need to take some drastic measures. We have to be pragmatic, however, in what we do during this time. There are some technical considerations that we also need to encapsulate in this plan. So no doubt the shift to renewables will offer a myriad of benefits. And obviously, what we are seeing now is that we're going to see a reduction in geopolitical security, which we've seen in Europe by and large. But I think there's a bigger question around how our grid has been structured. And I think a holistic investment program around the grid and integrating these renewables will be quite key. So today's grids are not prepared for the quick ramp up and ramp down. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we have what we call grid inertia that you try and minimize. So you have to have additional equipment or additional assets to try and balance and get that inertia back on. So, yes, you can talk about proper storage, but then there has to be grid control, there has to be grid stabilization that needs to be invested. So, it then comes to a point where I think we need to think about, do we have the time to make that investment on the grids element? Also, given that there's announcements around in the Northern Cape, fewer grid capacity. Where would we uptake? Where would the uptake of a 10 gigawatt come from? And the other technical allowance we need to have about is what we call capacity factor. Coal as it is, it's got about 60% capacity. So a gigawatt of coal at a 60% capacity has a lot more megawatt that you can dispatch, and it's dispatchable. Whereas the renewables are 30-odd percent lower. In terms of capacity factor. So the numbers, I think they wouldn't tally up to exactly what we're trying to get at. And I think we really then need to make decisions around what kind of a problem are we trying to solve. I think if we're talking about load or megawattage, they are not the same. There's a dispatchable one, which I think load shedding has exposed us to, that we really need to bring dispatchable load. But it cannot be, matched exactly with the renewable one that we talk about.
I think very important technical considerations there. Joanne, also from the IDC's vantage point, it has been made a core mandate to provide funding into the transition. You've set up a dedicated office to this end. But let's get your response firstly to the suggestions that have been put on the table by the MPC as far as Mark has articulated them. What do you make of them? Just unmute yourself, please, Joanne.
My apologies. After all 2 years of technology, one would think we would get that right. And I'm going to answer the question from two perspectives. The one is from the funding of energy, because we have played a key role in funding renewables from the time that it was not sexy for the banks to get involved in de-risking that early stage funding to the point that it is now, where funding for the renewable program is highly competitive, highly commoditized, and there's a lot of private sector funding available to fund the REAP program. And from that perspective, I think we welcome the suggestions. We're seeing a lot of rooftop and commercial and industrial solar funding that is not moving at the pace that it should move. So anything that can be done in a crisis situation to be able to really unlock that potential, I think, is absolutely imperative. Our concern from an industrial perspective on lifting the cap on localization is it needs to be done in a very managed and controlled way. There are certain components that we are able to provide locally, and we need to ensure that we don't lift it to the point that we undermine the just opportunity that comes from this in creating both technology certainty and job certainty for the workers in the component space, and also really to ensure that we leverage this crisis to drive further localization. Now, we've seen around the world that the commentary is becoming first about energy security and secondly about technology security, and we need to make sure that we consolidate from this point of crisis. You know, do not let the good crisis go to waste. Secondly, from an industrial perspective, the need to do more to support industry is absolutely critical. I mean, we're seeing the pain that is being felt by the manufacturers in the country that are putting hours that are lost in production that will never be regained. So I do think that part of the emergency opportunity is look at how we can accelerate some of the trading potential entities, so we can actually allow smaller participants to buy into renewable energy opportunities. At the moment, the renewable energy opportunity on a large scale is open to the large commercial users, but not to the small businesses that critically need not only the cost certainty, but also the reliable energy that allows them to keep people employed.
Yeah, I think there's so many issues in all of that to unpack. You know, is this a climate crisis? Is it an energy first crisis with localization? Do we get the electrons on the grid first and foremost, and then think about the ongoing build here, Mark, of a renewable program that's going to be 30 years, you know, after we get load shedding sorted in the next two? We've got another 28 years then to think about localization. How do you respond to what Thabo and Joanne have said?
Yeah, I strongly agree. I personally was very anxious about the reference to local content requirements, exactly for the reasons that Joanne was articulating. I mean, we simply can't say to workers, listen, we're going to keep the lights on, but you won't have a job. So we have to think about how renewable energy becomes the driver of upstream industrialization. And that's going to be absolutely critical. It happened before under apartheid with the build out of the energy infrastructure linked to coal. And now we've got a new set of energy technologies which can do the same thing, drive upstream industrialization. But for that, the price has to be right. If the prices are pushed down too low, then developers will only be able to build for a very low price if they import from China. So that's good for Chinese workers. It's not good for South African workers. So it's a complex issue to get this balancing act right. But from the National Planning Commission point of view, we don't want to compromise our long-term vision of sustained industrialization and job creation. While at the same time solving the load shedding crisis.
On that point, and I want to stay on that for a second longer, you know, the diffuse impacts of stage six load shedding throughout the broader economy, someone needs to model the jobs lost from that versus the jobs that might be retained through immediate localization. Every policy is a trade-off, and I still get the sense that we are feeling around a little bit in the dark when it comes to the localization idea. And I don't think anyone is against supporting new industry and using policy levers to do that, but right now the real emergency is, gee, let's keep the lights on. Let's keep those existing businesses who need power supported. I want to come back to the issue on grid stabilization and the capacity factor. How have these conversations been thought about in terms of what you're putting on the table? Because based on conversations of work that is afoot, Eskom certainly understands that any new power introduced to the grid requires modelling and obviously the potential assessment of impacts downstream on the major load centres and that kind of thing. And from what Thabo is saying, our grid really hasn't been designed for this.
Yeah, well, in the short term, you're probably going to need around 130, 150 billion rands for extending the grid as well as rehabilitating. But that capital is not going to happen until the national transmission company is up and running. And that the balance sheet of that national transmission company needs to be such that it's not carrying too much debt, so that it can raise the capital in order to do that grid extension work. And without that grid extension work, all the other wonderful stuff that we're talking about really won't happen. But if you look at the projections through to 2050, the grid extension work is only 10% of the capital requirements through to 2050. If you're looking at nearly 4 trillion rands worth of investment to get to net zero by 2050, 10% of that is the grid. So the grid is the small hinge that the big door swings on, and it has to be done properly with exactly what Tava is talking about, the flexibility rather than the one-way traffic grid that we've had in the past.
And in terms of the Just Transition Pact and that $8.5 billion that Daniel Manele is busy calling on projects for, and you know, we have had some feedback on the structure and the work streams now, do you see the bulk of that best used in the grid on that small hinge against which everything else swings?
Well, if the cost is right, it makes a lot of sense for that to go into the grid, but hopefully a significant chunk of that is the kind of grant funding that would make it possible to make a real impact on the just part of the just transition, which is essentially workers and communities in Mpumalanga. And that in turn links to the industrialization story. You know, just having ameliorative measures to cushion the effects of coal closure is not good enough. There needs to be a long-term vision that workers share in the possibility of upstream industrialization. So, you know, how you balance that out is going to be really critical. We shouldn't see the upstream industrialization as purely a market affair. It needs interventions in order for it to work. And the local content requirements are a critical part of that.
Yeah. As Siemens is a big OEM here, Tabo, and you know, we talk about localization, and I know Siemens is doing work in enterprise and supply development and contracting with local suppliers where you can. But what are the challenges? And let's better understand what those are in the sense of the coalition of the willing to see how we could manage getting electrons on the grid as quickly as possible, but also balancing that localization hurdle, which has been a hurdle in financial close for the latest bid window for renewable power.
Quite correct. And maybe I'll start with a picture on if we had to look at the long term in terms of direction of where we're going, and we had stability, we had consistency, and the timelines were predictable as well, we could see a trend where in the long term you had a higher renewable energy penetration, good energy storage, mix that with a renewable and a grid that ready for to integrate renewable energies. Then I think when we talk about technicalities about decommissioning coal, we don't need that because we would have created an end state that requires us to meet our NDC ambitions. Because green hydrogen at that point becomes important and it can be acted as our dispatchable technology. Now, if I, as the OEM, sit here with that vision in mind, I'm able to ensure that the necessary localization efforts can ensue, the necessary investments and skill sets can also be made well in time to ensure that it supports all of that. Now, if we look at where we stand, we've had a lot of stop-starts. We've had impacts where we had to revisit some of the interventions that we'd like to do because we are not sure of the state and the pace and the timing that some of those developments will do. So that impacts on the localization element. And I just want to come back on a point around what kind of a problem we're trying to solve. I think we also need to be clear that is it a long-term one, which is what I sketched, and there's a short-term one. And the short-term ones, there are certain measures that we can take today. And some of those, I think I agree with regards to some form of an emergency plan, because those needs to remove some of the bottlenecks. Procurement is one of those. Everybody agrees, be it from a DMR perspective, even from ESCOM perspective, procurement is a big hindrance in the type of crisis we're trying to solve. And I think that's one of the levers that we shouldn't leave out and look at the bigger projects. There are certain things we can do And there are certain elements we can start, which is stuff that we already have, and assets that we already have that we can improve maintenance on just by unbottling some of those stumbling blocks.
I think a very important point there that we haven't touched on, procurement. Joanne, just as we've got about 7 minutes left to go, I mean, there's almost a three-legged stool here when you talk about how we confront our energy challenge, and then also over the short and the long term, one of affordability, reliability, and sustainability. And they're very much interlinked. How do you see the hierarchy of those priorities given the state we're in currently with stage six load shedding?
So it's difficult. How do you impose the hierarchy? And I mean, I've said for a while, and I think the crisis reinforces that the beauty in South Africa at the moment from a climate perspective, so talking to sustainability, is that transitioning the economy to green energy is not going to create an electricity crisis. We have an electricity crisis. We have an affordability issue. So I do believe that the solutions we're looking at now and accelerating are solutions that address all of the three. You know, the crisis allows us to deal with affordability because we can provide certainty of supply to small businesses, communities on a sustainable basis. So I really do think we've got an opportunity to meet that the three pillars simultaneously. And I think the other critical area we need to be looking at is energy efficiency. You know, we constantly talk to energy supply, and that we need to build more.
Yeah,
but I think studies that I've read recently show that approximately one third of load shedding could be solved by energy efficiency. So how do we, alongside the installation of new generation capacity, look at how we become more effective users of electricity? Because that obviously has a direct impact on both affordability and ultimately sustainability.
Absolutely. And from the demand
side. And sustainability,
side,
not just private, sorry,
no,
of
yeah.
businesses as well. Cause the yeah. cost factor is just enormous.
Well,
sorry.
Well, and that's why, you know, it's sustainability with a big S and a small S, I think, as well. But, you know, we do talk a lot, Mark, about the supply side interventions. But it is also at the demand side where you know, I wrote a column recently about the potential, I'm just putting it out there, of mothballing Hillside and Mosul, and it certainly stoked a lot of interest. It's a deeply serious matter, and I think to even consider shutting down an entire industry just shows you the depth of the crisis. But the point I was really trying to make here is we need to start thinking about the fact that we are, in effect, using energy that we don't have to subsidize an industry on the back of our desire to industrialize and exporting our electricity when we don't have enough for our own consumption. It's like a water-scarce country exporting water-thirsty crops when you don't have enough water for your own people. I mean, that is a conversation we need to be having around the demand side. Just as you wrap this up, I'm sure you're very close to what's going on with your various hats. Is there sufficient political will now? And I ask that question deliberately because the Minister of Minerals and Energy so far has been one of the major obstacles to procuring new energy and ensuring that we get ahead of this crisis. And the Electricity Regulation Act empowers him with the measures to provide exemptions, to do whatever it takes, yet he's not doing it. Is there political will now?
Well, what we need to realize is that the Integrated Resource Plan provides for 26,000 megawatts of renewable energy through to 2030. By my calculation, there are 14,000 megawatts in shovel-ready projects. Eight of those is within the 100 megawatt category. So it's ready to roll. But I think what is new is a deep sense of crisis. And the statement that the president is taking the lead in resolving the crisis. And we've also heard from him and from others that we can expect within the next few days a very significant statement. And I think that is what we should look forward to. And when it comes out, we should really make sure that it's not just a technical solution where a bunch of experts are being mandated to fix this, but is a political solution that mobilizes the nation around a mission. We have to shift to mission-oriented politics rather than blaming or asking who benefits. We have to enlarge the vision if we really want to move forward.
Yeah, I can agree with that, because I think that tackles one key concern for me, and that has been the way that load shedding has sapped morale, sapped confidence from this economy, and is, let's be very frank here, leaning on decisions to emigrate to, and if you're in a fortunate, a very privileged position to have the skills and the ability to look for alternatives, we are losing skills and at an alarming rate. So we need to arrest that and stem that bleeding as well on the back of dealing with the energy crisis. Lots to do, and we're going to have to leave it there, sadly. We've run out of time. That was National Planning Commissioner Mark Swilling, joined around the table by Joanne Bate, Chief Operating Officer at the Industrial Development Corporation, and Thabo Molekoa, who is the MD of Siemens Energy.